Thanks, Graham, and thanks, Katie, for putting this session together. Another great IRAC session. Going to change tack from all of the chemical talks we've had to date and talk about what really matters in resistance management, and that's biotechnology. So resistance management and biotechnology really go hand in hand, and here I want to try and describe how we take resistance management learnings from what we've established in the US, what works and what doesn't work, and how to adapt those to different circumstances around the world. So there's some principles upon which we can base these decisions on, which are broadly outlined here. Firstly, and probably most importantly, and often gets forgotten is in resistance management discussions, is that these products, these biotech products, deliver important benefits to sustainable global agricultural systems. So that's the agricultural communities, to the environment, and to the global supply of food, fiber, and fuel. So insect resistance has a potential to reduce these benefits, which means that where resistance management is necessary to, if there is a resistance potential, and where measures that are both practical and effective can realistically be implemented, then appropriate IRM plans should be developed and implemented. On the other hand, if practical and effective resistance management is not achievable, or if resistance management is actually not necessary, resistance concerns should not prevent access to the immediate benefits of the technology. So if we can't prevent resistance from evolving, that doesn't mean we shouldn't go ahead and use the technology and derive the benefits from the technology in the short term. With that in mind, IRAC put together a few years ago a team around plant biotechnology to try to develop those principles across the world, where trying to move the discussion away from ideal resistance management to more practical resistance management. So we have a vision of what we think resistance management should look like for these products. So effective and practical IRM is a key component of biotech crop stewardship, enabling sustainable deployment. It's not an add-on. It's not something that we do after the fact. It's something that is built into the product concepts. It's built into the development plans. IRM involves all key stakeholders, including not just industry, but also academia, growers, grower advisors, grower groups, and regulators, and so forth. IRM is a key consideration in the development of all new insect-protected GM crops by public as well as the private sector. So where there are public sector efforts to develop BT vegetables and so forth, resistance management needs to be a cornerstone of those development plans as well. And IRAC is willing and able to assist in the development of those IRM plans so that those products are as sustainable as the ones that we develop. IRM does not then become an unreasonable burden to the technology providers or to the technology users, and it's not used as a barrier to commercial cultivation of insect-protected GM crops. Again, this is kind of a vision statement, what we'd like the world to look like. We may not be there in all circumstances right now. And that's because there's a high perceived risk of resistance with biotech products. And I probably don't need to go into great detail here, but high selection pressure across multiple generations, far more so than for insecticides. Initially, certainly there was a lack of diversity of active ingredients. There was a lot of reliance on Cry1A, B, Cry1AC type BT proteins. So there's a lot of pressure on a very narrow range of active ingredients. Complex mode of action for the BT proteins, which meant that there's multiple possible resistance mechanisms. And then resistance to BT sprayables has been observed in field, greenhouse, and generated in the lab. And all these concerns led to early predictions that if proactive resistance management isn't implemented, we will see resistance in 3 to 5 years. This, of course, was 12 or more years ago. So the actual risk is somewhat lower than the perceived risk. There are a few areas where BT crops have really dominated, some areas where they truly have, but few when you look across the world. And several of the key target pests of these products have a very broad host range, so actually only a small part of the population at any one time is being exposed to these proteins. Several of the key pests also show long-range dispersal and migration, so selection pressure that may be occurring in one region may in fact not impact the larger population once that dispersal migration process has completed. We're finding that genes conferring resistance have generally not been found at high levels in field populations. The best case is looking for Cry1AB resistance in European corn borer. A lot of dollars have been spent trying to find high levels of resistance and have not been successful. Where high levels of resistance have been found, they're generally, if not always, associated with high fitness costs. So clearly these BT proteins are attacking some vital process within the insect. And if the insect has to change that process, there are fitness costs associated with it. We're seeing increasingly over the last few years an increasing diversity of active ingredients, so they're not purely relying on the Cry1A BT proteins. And we're improving our understanding of how the different proteins are active in different insects. And then these BT proteins are not out there on their own. In most cases, if not all cases, there is ongoing management, pest management for both the target and other non-target pests of those crops. So we're seeing applications of insecticides to BT cotton, not necessarily to control the BT target, but to control a lot of the other insects that are present in that system. So although the resistance risks may not be as high as we initially believed, the regulators do tend to respond to the perceived risk. And they have shifting reasons for that. Initially, resistance was seen as a threat to organic production. If we lose Cry1A efficacy, all the organic producers will go out of business. But more recently, there's been a shift towards a reason as resistance would nullify all of the benefits of the technology. So the biotech products are seen as a societal good. And that's the very reason why resistance management should not be used as a barrier to introduction of these products. All insecticidal crops registered, though, by EPA require implementation of an approved resistance management plan. And then other countries look at what the US has done successfully, I'll believe. But what should they be doing in their local situations around the world? And they're looking to the US as the model. And that leads a tendency for a one-size-fits-all approach, which, as I will go into the rest of the talk, may not always be the best approach. So firstly, there are certainly challenges with the regulatory systems around the world in terms of how they want to try to implement resistance management. And I think one of the key problems is that the objective of IRM is often poorly defined. We heard in a couple of talks ago about various definitions of resistance from more academic to more practical, but without knowing what it is we're trying to manage or to avoid, it's very difficult to devise plans that will manage or avoid them. Often the protection goal is also not defined. So are they trying to protect an individual product from resistance, or do they actually want to protect the agricultural production system and make sure that the productivity can be maintained? And over what kind of time horizon should they be looking at? I've never seen that written down in a regulatory document. So what we end up with is terms like preserving susceptibility, which is really just too vague to be a useful goal in guiding the development of IRM plans. Second problem is that ideally IRM should consider the total system, and I think the last couple of talks have illustrated that very nicely. But from a regulatory standpoint, registrations are made on a specific trait by specific crop basis. They're also country specific. That may be the wrong geographic scale. We may need to manage resistance at a finer scale, or in fact, we may need to manage resistance across multiple countries. But that's not the way the regulatory systems work. And then regulations can be inflexible to integrating new thoughts, new ideas into managing pests. So integrating biotechnology with other pest management tools. Sometimes these IRM plans actually end up being barriers to successful IPM. And then finally, we find as we go around the world that the local regulatory capacity is often lacking. We're taking these products to countries where resistance management has never been on the front burner. They're learning as they go along and develop these regulations. And they need guidance from academics and from industry and from other stakeholders in terms of how those plans should be developed for their specific needs. So you can identify some global principles of IRM. And that is that the IRM plans should reflect local needs, local practices, and local opportunities, and that those plans should be commensurate with both the potential for resistance and the consequences of resistance. And I think often this consequences of resistance in the blue box is often ignored or glossed over. So resistance potential, I think we're all familiar with selection pressure, pest biology, the efficacy dose, mode of action of the protein, genetics of resistance, pest management operations, what pest management tools are being used, and then the broader cropping systems, how is one product integrated into the rest of the agricultural system. But the consequences of resistance also need to be considered. So what would be the impact on the sustainability of the agricultural system if there were resistance to evolve to one of the elements of that system? It's a question that's never really addressed. Would resistance affect a grower's ability to profitably raise a crop? Would resistance affect the technology provider's return on investment? Are alternative pest management tools available that would take care of any resistance issue? All of these should be considered in developing a resistance management program. So resistance in a secondary or sporadic pest would be of lower consequence than resistance in a key target pest where you have few other alternatives to control it. Two approaches to resistance management. One would be the proactive resistance management that we typically think about with biotech crops. And the second would be a reactive management of resistance that we would typically think about in the insecticide field. So proactive IRM plans, such as we see in the US, should be adopted where they are practical and necessary for long-term pest management. The elements are reducing selection pressure, controlling resistance alleles, or maintaining susceptibility in the population. And this is important because you need to anticipate future technologies. And what we see is that new technologies are brought forward. They're often based on today's existing technologies. So we need to be careful today to make sure that what we have today is still available as the new technologies come through. However, reactive approaches can be appropriate where those proactive approaches are either not necessary or not practical. So measures can be taken in response to changes in product performance, be it application of an alternative pest control measure, use of a different transgenic trait. And then once you actually have resistance in your hand, you know what it is you're actually trying to manage now, so you can develop some more intricate case-specific resistance management practices because you know what it is that you're trying to deal with and what may or may not be effective. So this, as I say, comes down to managing resistant populations, which hopefully will also result in reversion of resistance. So the structured refuge-based proactive IRM cannot be universal. And there are some big challenges to how refuges would be implemented in a lot of the systems we look at around the world. They can be, and I think they've proven to be a very powerful IRM tool. But growers do bear significant short-term individual cost for what is an uncertain long-term and system-wide benefit. So the ability of a grower to embrace the concept depends a lot on the socioeconomics that grower faces. They're not allowed to capture the full potential value of the technology in the short term, and planting a refuge, managing a refuge, complicates their crop management process. So it requires a sophisticated infrastructure to implement successfully. You need a strong and respected regulatory regime to get growers to look at the greater good and not the individual. You need an educated and prosperous farming community. The refuge approach won't work in a subsistence farming community where just producing enough food to feed the community is the goal. Need easy information access, so the growers really understand why they need to do and what they need to do. And then you need effective, organized grower groups that will be able to provide consistent messaging across the grower community, as well as, I think we've seen, the power of peer pressure to do the right thing. But what we see is that local circumstances will demand local practices. So socioeconomics and infrastructure really become severe limitations to proactive IRM. Look at variation in farm scale from farms that are less than 5 hectares to farms that are greater than 5,000 hectares. Clearly the opportunities for resistance management as well as the needs for resistance management are going to be different in those systems. Profitability, I just talked about, education level of the growers, familiarity with new technologies, the regulatory system, and enforceability of regulations, information access for growers and seed dealers, is there a strong extension service, are there frequent grower meetings where this information can get across, is the internet a useful approach to education? Do growers traditionally get information about resistance management, about the products that they're buying from the seed companies, or is it just word of mouth from their friends? And then effective grower organizations. With a strong grower organization like the National Corn Growers Association or National Cotton Council in the US, the power of those organizations to get the growers to implement refuges is extremely important. But in a lot of the places where this technology is needed, those organizations are less well organized, less powerful. But fortunately, we don't need to rely on refuges wherever we go. And we won't read through this whole list, but there are a series of tactics that can be used in resistance management, some more effective than others, some more necessary than others. They all have their strengths and limitations. But it does give us some flexibility in how we go about managing resistance around the world. So we can look at the US situation. We'll look at the first generation Cry1 BT maize products. Here we're looking at large mechanized farms covering multiple acres with huge planters. So the refuge options become possible. We look at biological factors involved. What are the key pests that we really would be concerned about developing resistance? And certainly European corn borer will be the one here that dominates our thinking. So what are the properties of the product against European corn borer? We're familiar with it being a high-dose product. European corn borer mostly has a narrow host range, one or two generations per year. Adult mobility, larval mobility, both fairly moderate, and a very uniform response to the BT proteins. Not a lot of variability for selection to act on. Operational factors, again, mostly large mechanized farms, large fields, landscape dominated, certainly across the Midwest, by corn and a non-host crop. And then you look at the socioeconomics and infrastructure. So again, it's these corporate farms, generally highly profitable, looking to the long-term success of the farming system, a strong education system, strong extension system, strong regulatory system, and efficient means of information dissemination to the from the technology providers down to the end user. So what we see here is that proactive IRM is important, and it's also practical through a structured refuge-based approach. A lot of emphasis on education and compliance monitoring to make sure growers really understand what they should be doing, why they should be doing it, and actually are doing it. This is an example of the most recent education campaign in the U.S., Respect the Refuge, put together by National Corn Growers Association in collaboration with the tech providers. So why should growers be planting a refuge? And what are the consequences of not planting a refuge? Just to remind growers that this is an important aspect of growing a BT crop. We can look at a situation somewhat different. Here we'll look at Cry1 BT maize in Brazil. Here we're looking at a different suite of pests that the products target. So we've got fall armyworm and sugarcane borer. For now, I'll just focus on fall armyworm. Here, depending on exactly which protein, which product you're looking at, it's somewhere between a moderate and a high dose. It's not the very high dose that we see with European corn borer. Fall armyworm has a much broader host range, multiple generations per year, high adult mobility, high larval mobility, and there is considerable variation in response to the BT proteins across different populations of fall armyworm. Operational factors, there's a lot more diversity in Brazil, so we're looking at a mixture of large corporate farms and much smaller family operations. That's produces a diversity of field sizes and a much greater diversity of the agricultural landscape, at least compared with the Midwest in the US. Socioeconomics, relatively strong education and extension system. We do have efficient information dissemination mechanisms. Growers do tend to embrace IRM. They've had resistance problems with fall armyworm and with multiple products. They understand what they're facing. And here we see a much more hands-off regulatory approach in terms of not being perhaps as rigid as in the US. So again, here we see that proactive IRM is important. The structured refuge approach seems to be a suitable one for the sugarcane borer, for Dietrea. The natural refuge approach is probably more appropriate for Spodoptera with its broad host range. Again, a lot of emphasis on grower education and monitoring. This is an example of education piece that was produced this year as the products are starting to hit the market. How should growers be handling refuges in their system? And then just quickly, a third contrasting situation, same product but in the Philippines now, dealing with a very different geographic system, very different socioeconomic system. Key pest here now is the Asian corn borer, very similar biology to the European corn borer. Here we do see high dose, we see a moderate host range, multiple generations per year, it's a tropical environment again. Probably somewhat more isolated because we're talking about a mountainous archipelago. Moderate larval mobility, but again, a uniform response to proteins. Here we're talking about almost entirely small family farms. We're talking about farms of 1 or 2 hectares, very small field sizes. So clearly structured refuge deployment becomes a lot more complicated, a lot less practical. We do also see diversity in the agricultural landscape. There's a lot of crop rotation and multiple crops each year on the same land. Socioeconomics, again, smallholder farms, less affluent, variable education and extension system, less efficient in information dissemination. But here we are seeing the regulators are very closely involved. But what we see is that proactive IRM may not be needed initially. We've got small farm sizes, non-adopting farms are providing that refuge, as well as the alternate hosts. The model here then is IRM based on technology adoption. So a natural refuge is appropriate where adoption is low. In areas where adoption is high, then a structured refuge approach makes more sense. So again, a lot of education, a lot of monitoring, field monitoring. There's an example of a field monitoring report form that growers can use when they're looking for damage by the Asian corn borer. So just to sum up, and I know I'm running over time, Graham. IRM is responsible stewardship. It should consider the entire system across different traits, across different crops, different products, etc. It should account for and encourage diversity of available traits. The diversity of different active ingredients really is a powerful tool at diluting selection pressure for resistance to any one. Should involve public and private sector efforts to develop biotech crops, and it should reflect local agricultural practices and IPM. Local stakeholder involvement in both plan design and implementation is important, and then cross-industry coordination through groups like IRAC or through local country groups becomes extremely important for successful resistance management across that system. So just to sum up, keeping resistance management in perspective, again, GM crops deliver important benefits to a sustainable agricultural system. It's important to protect those benefits. It's also important to not let resistance management prevent access to those benefits, either through overly burdensome regulations or requirements, or through not permitting products to be deployed where really highly effective resistance management is not practical. And with that, I'll take any questions at this time. Thank you.